morning on an Aloha Friday. Kamana Beamer looks at the reasons behind the letter questioning the Hawaiian Kingdom's existence. And later in the hour, UC Berkeley biologist Tyrone Hayes considers the unintended consequences of pesticides and Hawaii's place in that research.
Respect for the ocean is a big part of life in Hawaii, and it's also the driving force of the Summer Surf Celebration Film Fest. We'll talk with the man behind the festival, Ian Masterson. And as usually happens, the past comes back, this time with a pleasant outcome. Jerry Tracy is Mark Twain in Hawaii. I'm Chris Vanderpool.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's Friday, May 16th, and that's The Conversation right after this news.
Good morning and welcome to The Conversation. I'm Chris Vandercook. Good morning, Beth Ann.
Good morning.
Lots of discussion in the aftermath of that OHA letter, yeah?
And a whole lot more to come, but it is our first conversation this morning. You remember that a week ago we learned of the letter sent by OHA CEO Kamanaʻopono Crabb to Secretary of State John Kerry asking whether the Hawaiian Kingdom exists and is subject to international law. If so, the request for inquiry ended with another question. Were there legal and criminal implications for the Native Hawaiian Roll Commission and the OHA trustees and staff? The letter sparked accusations and counter-accusations within OHA, a letter rescinding the original letter, then several trustees who rescinded their support for that second letter. Last night, the trustees met on Maui, and the split of opinion in and outside of OHA continues. UH School of Hawaiian Language, Hawaiian Knowledge and Law School professor Kamana Beamer joins us now with his assessment of the situation. Good morning, and thank you for making time for us today.
Aloha. Great to be with you folks, and thank you for teeing up this very important conversation for what's going on in Hawaii today.
Well, you know, those progressive questions of Dr. Crabb's letter led to that question of legality and possible criminality for the Hawaiian roll call. Should this have been asked earlier, before the roll call campaign?
You know, this is a powerful question to really give clarity in terms of what the true political history of Hawaii is in the past and how it can lead us towards the future. I do think that, you know, had these questions been addressed in the upfront, they would have been unifying and enabled people to move forward with clarity and direction.
And perhaps been even more powerful?
Perhaps it would have. You know, these questions really originated from a process that OHA took to step back. You know, the trustees did a remarkable thing, which was to adopt a policy that said they were going to facilitate the conversation around governance. This was a movement that OHA never had really entered into in the past. Previously, they were strong advocates for federal recognition. But when they adopted this policy of facilitation, many people came into the conversation that began to ask some of these questions that really are founded in cutting-edge research that's been coming out of the University of Hawaii over the last 8 to 10 years.
Dr. Crabb's letter made some people uncomfortable. Did he make the right people uncomfortable?
You know, I think he did. You know, the truth is what will liberate us. And so we need to be able to ask questions in order to guide where we move forward in our future. And Hawaii's political history is complex. You know, all of us love and aloha this beautiful place. It's an amazing place to be. And at the same time, we have a history of injustice that needs to be recognized and needs to come to the forefront for the betterment, really, of all of Hawaii.
We're not exactly at that solution point, but asking those questions and seeing what options and what legalities are involved in all of this seems to be where the push is now, as you've just mentioned. Was this also a really good move of strategy to bring this back into the consciousness of the U.S. State Department?
You know, I think what Dr. Crabb was doing was conducting his fiduciary duty. What really facilitated this was a presentation that took place at the Richardson Law School, in which you had Dr. Keanu Sai, Professor Williamson Chang, as well as former Governor John Waihe'e. And, you know, even at that particular presentation, Governor John Waihe'e, I'm summarizing it, but he basically said you'd have to be illiterate not to realize that Hawaii is occupied. And so Dr. Crabb, I think, upon hearing this and these allegations, thought that he needed to get clarity from the U.S. State Department if, in fact, Hawaii is occupied under international law. And what would the ramifications look like for someone that's in his position today? And I really think that's all he's seeking to do.
By the very nature of it, though, it has brought it back into the consciousness of a lot of us, and certainly given some of what we saw come out of Washington and the way it was covered, it didn't go unnoticed. That seems to be a good thing.
I think it's important. Look, America, you know, land of the free, home of the brave. We have this deep, dark place of injustice here in Hawaii, and our relationship with America has been strained. You know, President Cleveland, as well as President Clinton, admitted the overthrow of the Hawaiian Kingdom was illegal. And I hope that, you know, people aren't so numb and so subdued that we can't really talk about what justice for Hawaii looks like today. And how do we move forward?
So how do we move forward from this step when it seems to be there's a split within OHA itself and outside of it, and people having great support for the letter that Dr. Crabb wrote and others who are still wondering if this was the best move?
You know, I think this is a good thing that's happening. We've brought people to the conversation that really haven't been taken part in this conversation and possibly have been kind of ignored for a period of time.
Who would that be?
You know, groups that are looking at Hawaii's status under international law. I mean, given that OHA had a previous position of really advocating for federal recognition, I think there was an unwillingness to address some of these questions. So I think it's important. And moving forward, I mean, what you witnessed, you know, last night on Maui was staunch support for Dr. Kamanaʻopuna Crabb and his courageous leadership in just asking some questions that are important for the future of Hawaii. And I think it's going to galvanize support, and we're going to see people come together for justice with Aloha for Hawaii.
As you assess this situation, what would you like to see happen as the next step?
You know, I'd like to see the trustees get those questions answered by the State Department. I think they're critical and important towards making decisions and how we move forward in Hawaii today. I'd like to ask, you know, everyone in Hawaii to take a step back and think about your love for this place, your love for Hawaiian music, the songs you sang in school, and think about what you can do for justice for Hawaii, because it's important, it's critical. We're facing, you know, changes in climate, natural resources, and these issues about justice are imperative for us to move forward together.
That's a very big shopping list. But is there something in particular that you'd like to see people focus on in a way that they haven't before, given what we've seen over this last week?
Sure. You know, there's a petition that emerged. It's called He Mana Opono. In as little as a week, we have over 2,300 signatures. If you're in support of justice for Hawaii, it would be fantastic to place your name on this petition. We have people that have signed on from at least, 19 different countries, as well as numerous Hawaii residents, both ethnically Hawaiian and not. And that's one important step, is just to, you know, bring this conversation to the forefront.
And do you think that will make a difference to the State Department?
Absolutely.
All right, we're going to leave it there on that hopeful note. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much. Aloha.
Aloha. Dr. Kamana Beamer is an assistant professor in the Hui Aina Momona program, split between the UH Schools of Hawaiian Knowledge and Law. His research focuses on indigenous agency, Native Hawaiian land tenure, and the land and resource law of the Hawaiian Kingdom.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported HPR2. It's 8:13. Later in the show, a celebration of surf culture in time for summer. But first, today's backyard quiz.
Unihua, ulehua, unihau, ukaua, uahu, umulokai, ulanai, umau, ukaholabe, uhawai.
Yesterday we talked about a tree with rainbow hues. Today, a look at Rainbow Stadium. You probably know it as Les Murakami Stadium, and it has been home to the UH Rainbow Warriors baseball team since its opening on February 17, 1984. In 2002, the University of Hawaii decided to change the name of the venue to honor UH baseball coach Les Murakami. He had been instrumental in the planning and construction of the stadium. That, plus his years of service as head coach, according to UH, warranted the name change and dedication. Murakami's name even resonates among mainland college baseball fans, as he's won over 1,000 games in his career, an achievement not easily attained. Some of his other achievements include twice as Hawaii Sportsman of the Year and induction into the American Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame. For today's quiz, do you know the affectionate nickname fans often use to refer to Les Murakami Stadium? Give it a try on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation, or call us with the answer at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. If you strike out, no worries. We'll tell you later in the show.
Support for The Conversation comes from Hawaii Theater Center, presenting The Legend of Ko'olau, an historical drama set during the overthrow of the Hawaiian monarchy. 7:30 tonight, hawaiitheater.com.
The ocean is vast and unknowable, and surfers feel a special connection to its mysteries. Reverence for the ocean is central to surf culture and to Ian Masterson's mission at Windward Community College. He's presenting a free surf film festival at the school with the goal of directing students and the general public to a greater appreciation and understanding of the sea around us. He joins us by phone. Good morning, Ian.
Good morning, Chris. Aloha, Bethan. How are you? Thank you for having me.
Sure. You've got a bit of an ulterior motive in this film festival, in the sense of telling people about your programs, the Ocean Education Academy, yeah?
Indeed. But also to foster our ocean community through these films.
Well, by teaching the things that you've got a real teaching mandate at WCC, yeah, as far as teaching the ways of the ocean, ocean rescue, things like that?
Yes, absolutely. Both in relation to state mandates for safe boat education, as well as, more importantly, because ocean recreation is so important for our state, and ocean safety starts with knowledge about the environment and the way that we have approached the ocean here in Hawaii over time.
Well, it seems pretty appropriate that this kind of education be kind of pioneered in Hawaii, yeah?
Yes, and pioneered long before our time, with people like Duke Pauakahanamoku and Tom Blake, who really worked hard to bring us forward. George Freeth, too.
Well, by putting it into an academic setting, what are the things that you emphasize?
For us today, because ocean recreation is not only our most popular kind of fun here in Hawaii to have, but also a really strong economic engine. The idea is to educate people about the ocean environment, as well as best practices and skills in the ocean, principles and practices, and especially for me, social and Hawaiian cultural aspects of our relationship with the sea.
What do you think are the things that the most important things that maybe people don't know?
There are many common
mistakes in approaching the ocean, especially with regards to considering maybe flat water might be the safest place to swim, but that's probably where the currents are moving offshore. And so through just learning how to read a beach and to understand the coastal environment, we can prevent many incidents from occurring.
Learning, that's an interesting term, how to read a beach. I think a lot of visitors wouldn't begin to know what that meant, yeah?
Indeed, and yet it's for many of us who have grown up in Hawaii and for many Native Hawaiians, understanding that, being able to understand the size of the sand grains and the way that the currents are flowing, all speaks to us. We can learn to read that, and I really appreciate all of the people who have that knowledge, that education, and that's, you know, really unique to our culture.
One of the things that's unique to local culture is some of the rescue methods that have really been pioneered here in Hawaii, yeah?
Oh, absolutely. And, our first instructors, Brian Keaulana and Ken Bradshaw, who started the Ocean Safety Educational Course many years ago, really were at the forefront of developing many of these systems and techniques. And others like Terry Ahui and Melvin Pu'u, you know, created the rescue board that got onto the jet ski that brought us to the forefront of ocean safety in the world.
And that was developed in Hawaii, the whole use of a jet ski and trailing a board to pluck somebody out of the water. Wasn't that pretty much originated here?
Yes, from those great watermen I just mentioned and many others involved. It was created here, and we really refined it here in such a way to... The jet ski is really, for us, a rescue craft because it is the most innovative and effective craft in the nearshore ocean environment among the waves.
It has a whole new relevance when you look at it as a rescue craft, don't you?
Yes, and I think you found my emphasis right there, that for us, it's not necessarily a thrill craft. We can all drive it fast, but becoming a good operator, a skilled operator, is the key to utilizing the equipment. And so we should look at it as a rescue craft because it saves many lives.
I've seen Oahu's lifeguards exercise, you know, drilling in the whole process of plucking somebody out of the water. And a jet ski cuts right through the waves, takes you right to the person in trouble, and you can throw them on the back and be gone and like that, yeah?
Yes, in fact, you could respond, you know, 3,000 feet offshore and get back in with your... with the person who is in trouble in time to save their life, even perhaps before, you know, 4 to 6 minutes when everything starts to shut down.
Sure. Has it spread around the world?
It has. And, you know, there are many excellent operators and many educators out there. And just jet skis have not only spread because of the rescue aspect, but also the thrill of tow-in surfing, as that has popularized it through the globalization of our surf culture.
But and as surf culture gets globalized, so do its risks, right?
Absolutely. Can you imagine there are 19 million surfers worldwide? That's powerful. That's a lot of people in the ocean as well. So we want to encourage education in all aspects of safe boating and ocean recreation and jet ski operations, PWC operations, I should say.
Well, because in a sense, that's a lot of people at risk, many of whom might not be as versed in ocean culture as somebody who grew up in Hawaii, right?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, it goes back to Duke, who surfing is his passion and what he wanted to share with the world. But it was his educating all of us on swimming techniques and swimming in the ocean against a 5-knot current that really we can credit him as having prevented more ocean incidents over the history of time than any other single person. And so that is the foundation for us to grow on and to share.
Well, there's quite a tradition established here in Hawaii. Is Hawaii recognized around the world as for its leadership in these areas?
I would like to think so. Of course, many communities, like Australia as well, have become very strong in their ocean rescue abilities and surf clubs, and yet that, again, came from Duke's introduction in many ways. So Hawaii is definitely recognized, and with the group of Hawaiians that have led the way in developing the techniques by being out there, by the necessity of it, yes, people come from around the world to train, and so we want to give that opportunity to the public here at Windward Community College through our Hawaii Ocean Education Academy.
Well, good to talk to you, Ian. Thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you, and you I'd bet. Love to see you all down at the Summer Surf Film Fest.
We'll send them your way. Ian Akahi Masterson is a Workforce Development Coordinator for Windward Community College and the guiding spirit for the Summer Surf Celebration Film Fest. It's Paliku Theater on the WCC campus, Thursday, May 29th from 5 to 9 p.m. It's free, and you can learn more at hpr2.org.
An Antarctic ice sheet the size of the Dakotas has begun to melt. I'm Ira Flatow. Join me on Science Friday for a look at the consequences of rising sea levels, plus why some experts say we should keep that smallpox virus around, and the history of invisible ink and how it relates to NSA secrets today, all on Science Friday from PRI.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after the conversation.
HPR's base of support continues to grow, thanks to enthusiastic response to our Plus One new member program. Thanks to Ty Jenkins and Your Plus One, Mary Suzanne Palumbo, Alana Coffey and Your Plus One, Helen Platel, and Robert Peeo and Your Plus One, Dean Neubauer, for participating in the Plus One campaign. Visit hawaiipublicradio.org/plusone. To find out more, or you can call us at 955-8821 during business hours. The governor made it official yesterday. Just in case there was any doubt, he'll cap his political career with his bid for re-election. Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair takes a look at the governor's formal filing of candidate papers for what the governor called his final campaign. Good morning.
Good morning and happy Aloha Friday, Beth Ann.
Nice that we've reached this point in the week. But as you look back at what the governor had to say yesterday, it seemed to be that it was fairly charged with emotion.
Well, think about this. This is a man who first ran for office in 1970. He was a grad student at UH. He ran for the U.S. Senate. Very bold, brazen thing to do. And, of course, he didn't make it. But that's how far back his political career goes in this state. That's 5 decades now in public service, during which time mostly he has held elective office. And now he's at the top position, hoping for another 4 years.
And also a chance to be able to formally define the legacy of his administration.
Right, and they've got him on his talking points. He's saying that he made the right decisions concerning the budget crisis he says he encountered when he became governor, and that he has the right values and priorities and so forth. These are the kind of themes, messages that you're seeing in his advertising. And one of the things about Neil Abercrombie is he can tend to stray from the topic. You get him talking on something, you know this very well. He'll go on and on, and who knows what he'll say. But yesterday,
well, sometimes that's when the good stuff comes out, you know.
That would, in fact, be exactly when the good stuff comes along. But they have him on his talking points, and it's a very united campaign theme. Not only was he filing his paperwork yesterday, but his campaign was sending out releases, and he's got ads running, and it was a special moment for the governor. This is indeed his last campaign. He turned 76, by the way, next month.
Well, because of all that, is there sort of a final frontier in this final campaign?
Well, in many ways, it could be his hardest time ever in running for election. David Ige is giving him a spirited, maybe serious Democratic primary run, and then if the governor should get past the primary, he faces the same two guys he faced in 2010. Now, he beat Duke Ayona and Mufi Hanneman pretty badly, but this time they're all in the same race, a three-way divided race for governor, and, you know, one-third of the vote, potentially, 30 or 40%, could win the governorship.
Which means we may see a very different type of campaign this time around.
Yeah, I think so. And that's one reason the governor is raising money like crazy. He has another campaign fundraiser tonight in Kahala. It's his fifth this month. He's clearly planning for the long game, if you will.
All right. Well, we're going to be watching it, and we know we'll be talking about it. Thanks, Chad. Have a good weekend. See you Monday.
Thanks, Beth. Bye-bye.
Chad Blair writes on politics for CivilBeat.com.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the St. Andrews Schools, offering K-12 for girls at the Priory and K-5 for boys at the Prep, currently accepting applications. Learn more at standrewsschools.org.
And as it's a Friday, we always take a look at what's coming up. And out of our news department for the coming week, Bill Dorman, Hawaii Public Radio's news director, joins me now with a look. We were just talking about the governor's final campaign.
Yeah.
He's doing something that a lot of people have been finally hoping would happen.
Yeah, it's interesting in terms of development and political compromise. You know, Chad was talking about sort of the political history there. A lot of folks, this is the conservation preservation measure about Turtle Bay. And the governor is due to sign it at the beginning of the week. And certainly, talk about political compromise. And one way you can tell that for sure is that people on both sides of this remain a little unhappy.
Yeah, nobody's happy. You've got a good compromise.
Yes, exactly. But at the same time, it is it's an achievement that a lot of people said would never happen, would never get to this point even. But then part of the question that remains, of course, is okay, fine, where does this go from here, and how does this get applied in real life? So we'll be taking a look at that with an eye to sort of what comes next with all of that. And
also there's a big meeting next week about Kaka'ako, and everybody and their uncle is going to be there.
Exactly. You know, it's interesting. There are various panels at different points, of course, talking about different topics of our development future, of our future generally. But this one about Kaka'ako, it includes developers, community activists, representatives of HCDA, City Council, Kamehameha Schools, UH, OHA. It's a really big group. Again, it's a wide open discussion. There's a lot to sort of, it's a very broad topic in terms of, yeah, what about the future of Kaka'ako? Well, where do you start?
But it's good that all those stakeholders are there and where other people can see what's going on with those many people who are there.
Yeah, and again, every opportunity for community involvement at a very basic level when the real players are there, it's important. It's important to know about. It's important to follow up. So Wayne Yoshioka is going to be tracking that next week.
Now, what about what's going on with our coral?
Coral, you know, such an important resource. I know you guys spend a lot of time here on the show talking about it. We do in news. There's a group of scientists at Gates Lab on Coconut Island over on the windward side that is building coral nurseries. And what they want to do is to see if there are certain species that can adapt to warmer water. Talking about climate change, about change in water temperature, what sort of research, what that means in the context of global warming and in human reaction to it. And Molly Solomon spent some time over there, and she'll have some details next week.
Looking forward to hearing that part. Now, we would be remiss in not talking about what's coming up in arts and culture.
Yeah, Ikebana, you know, flower arranging, big time, big in Japan for centuries, big in Hawaii, of course. In fact, the Sogetsu School of Ikebana, celebrating its 50th anniversary
Wow.
here in Hawaii. Number of commemorations underway this month, and a big floral exhibition that opens to the public next weekend. Noe Tanigawa is going to have a lot about that and about Ikebana more generally here in the islands.
Noe Tanigawa, also known as our resident floral arranger.
Yeah, exactly. Talk about firsthand experience with this. She helps beautify the newsroom.
And if you've ever been around here, all those lovely arrangements that you see come from Noe's garden. Good.
Yeah.
We'll look forward to all that. Thanks,
you
Bill.
Bet.
Have
you
a good
bet.
Weekend.
You too.
Bill Dorman report. Bill Dorman is Hawaii Public Radio's news director.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tori Richard, a Kama'aina company, creating clothing for the Hawaiian island lifestyle since 1956. Proud to support local, national, and international news programming on HPR. ToriRichard.com.
Almost a year ago, documents were released following a Freedom of Information request about a court case involving Swiss herbicide maker Syngenta. What was in those unsealed documents shocked some people, including University of California Berkeley biologist Tyrone Hayes. He had been targeted by the company to be discredited because his research on their product, atrazine, had shown that it transformed male frogs into fully functioning reproductive females. Tyrone Hayes is in Hawaii to talk about the unintended consequences of agricultural chemicals. We spoke yesterday, and I asked him what happened to him in this last year.
Oh, it's been a busy year. It's been a busy year because the research is going very well. We are still uncovering a lot of problems with atrazine and other pesticides and linking it to the human condition. In terms of me personally, it's been quite a whirlwind. So it's I'm still going through some of the documents, still in disbelief at some of the extent to which the manufacturer was able to go to try to get to me. It, you know, it obviously wasn't the science that they were after. It was me. And it's, you know, really gotten a lot of attention in the public. There's documentary filmmakers and filmmakers that are interested in developing the story, and I hope that'll help get the information out and available to more people.
And might fund some more research. For you, as you look at the future now, not just with those projects that you just named, but looking at how you want to refine your research, you mentioned that we're now looking at the links to humans. What specifically are you working on now?
Well, there are a number of studies coming out now showing that atrazine is associated with, we already knew about the breast cancer and the prostate cancer concerns, but there's a lot of studies now focusing on birth defects in women who are exposed to atrazine during their pregnancy, leading to a number of birth defects and abnormalities. Probably the most notable are the abnormalities to the male genitalia. So babies, male babies, boys who are exposed to atrazine in the womb come out with abnormal penises and non-descended testicles, which, you know, that effect is consistent with how we know atrazine works.
And being correlated to places in which you know where atrazine was sprayed?
Yes, so these are studies that are coming out across different places in the United States, and the information is that during women who get pregnant during peak atrazine contamination times tend to have more of these birth defects and abnormalities at birth.
So, for example, in the Midwest where it's used a great deal on corn?
Yes, there are people looking at in Indiana and Iowa. There are a number of ongoing studies still examining those correlations.
When can we expect to see some of these studies?
Some of them are already published, so there's one study showing that atrazine is associated with gastroschisis, and that's a birth defect where the baby is born with the intestines on the outside of its body. There's another paper that's been published showing that atrazine is associated with coenal atresia when babies are exposed in utero, and that's a birth defect where the oral and the nasal cavity don't close up, so the baby has a hole in its face. And then most recently, a study just came out showing that male babies are born with something called microphallus, where the penis doesn't grow, non-descended testicles, where the scrotum is empty, or hypospadias, where the urethra doesn't come all the way through the penis. And all of those conditions are associated with atrazine exposure in utero when the mother's pregnant.
Specifically to you, what do you want to be doing from this point forward?
For me, I really want to continue to explore atrazine as a tool to understand science, to understand developmental biology of amphibians, but I also want to continue to use my work to examine how atrazine and other pesticides in the environment are affecting things like the rate of breast cancer and breast cancer mortality and prostate cancer and low sperm count. So I want to, you know, continue to expand that work to look at how chemicals that we've created are, you know, supposedly to help us are actually hindering our health. And really, I think the most atrocious thing is affecting the unborn fetus, so babies who come out and don't even have the same kinds of chances as others. And I'm particularly interested in how minorities and people from low-income communities are more likely impacted, and you know, really trying to get rid of that disparity.
As you do all of this, that's going to bring you right up against a great deal of companies who are still engaged in doing exactly what they're doing, making other chemicals to be used in the ways that we've been using them for quite a while. Do you have any concern for your personal safety, even after all of these other documents were unsealed last year?
Well, I mean, I think the thing that gives me comfort is that, you know, for the last 15 years, Syngenta has spent millions of dollars and countless hours, one, trying to poke holes in my science, and they couldn't, and two, digging into my background, trying to find, you know, there are all these notes that they wrote about trying to link me to a scandal and trying to set traps to entice me to do things, and they were unable to do that. So I think, as I said to someone earlier, I've been tested by the best. I have no fear of the rest. I'm here to do a job, and I'm going to get that job done.
I want to talk to you about the job that you see that Hawaii needs to do. How would you peg where Hawaii is now in its understanding of some of the issues that you like to talk about?
Wow. I've just started learning about Hawaii. There's a big concern because of the watershed. You know, it's an island, right, where fresh water is incredibly important. I'm just learning now the extent to which the pesticide and the big agribusiness have impacted Hawaii, and the amount of land and the amount of pesticides and the amount of GMOs that are really being tested here. So, and it's just such a beautiful but yet also fragile environment, as we know, that it raises great concern both for the wildlife as well as for the people and the culture. So I'm very excited to be a part of it. I've been here a few times, as you may know, and I'm very excited to be here and to be a part and to be able to offer my experience and my information and my expertise.
We were regarded in some ways as being sort of ground zero for GMO legislation in the last year or so, and we've seen how that's played out and some of that coming back to court. There are ways in which the community has responded to all of that. Do you think that there's any sort of mistake that the community has been making as it approaches coming up against a giant like Monsanto?
No, I'm very happy. I've been following the news. I've been following the information. I have lots of friends in Hawaii. I've worked with some of the lawyers here that are working on these issues. And one of my former students works with Pesticide Action Network, so I followed some of the information and some of the news coming out of Hawaii. I think that Hawaii, it would be in Hawaii's best interest to look at some of the battles that have happened, for example, in Minnesota and in Tasmania and other places where chemical companies have fought people who are trying to clean up the environment and trying to stop both GMO and pesticide use in their communities.
And what do you think the basic lesson that we might take from them in a way that we haven't taken lessons before?
Well, I mean, as you mentioned earlier, the companies aren't going to stop. They're really going to try to play on this idea that they are growing food to feed the world, which, it's just not the case. I mean, that's not the interest of the agribusiness. If you look at, globally, 20% of the world dies because they don't have access to staples. And in the United States, for example, our major crop is corn, of which we directly eat less than 2% of. It's really about profits and making money. It's not about, maybe there's somebody in the company who really cares about feeding the world, but I think ultimately it's all about money, just in the way that we do business. So they're really protecting their profit, not protecting any kind of thing that's good for society, good for people. At least that's my opinion.
Thanks so much for making time for us. I know your schedule is packed, and we appreciate the fact you're able to spend a little time with us this morning.
Well, thank you very much.
Tyrone Hayes is professor of integrative biology at the University of California, Berkeley. He's best known for his findings that Swiss chemical company Syngenta's herbicide atrazine is an endocrine disruptor. Dr. Hayes is also an advocate for critical review and regulation of pesticides and other chemicals that may cause adverse, unintended health effects. He's in Hawaii on the statewide speaking tour. More about it is on our Facebook page, Hawaii Conversation.
America's national pastime is the subject of today's Backyard Quiz, and of course we're talking about baseball. This morning we homed in on former UH Rainbow Warrior head coach Les Murakami. He's known as one of the best coaches in college baseball history, with over 1,000 wins, 1,079 wins, and 11 conference championships during a three-decade-plus career. Other achievements, including twice being named Hawaii Sportsman of the Year and induction into the American Baseball Coaches Association Hall of Fame. In 2002, UH Manoa's Rainbow Stadium officially became Les Murakami Stadium. Today, we asked you about the stadium's nickname. To this day, many fans and players affectionately refer to it as the house that Les built. It's 8:46, and that's today's quiz. If you have one, you can send it to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaii Supply, announcing Radiance Reflective Roof Shingles, solar reflective shingles designed and made for Hawaii to reflect the heat and help keep homes cool. Learn more at radianceroof.com.
Mark Twain is one of America's great storytellers, a writer who did as much as anyone to create the American identity. His own identity was forged by his early work as a newspaper reporter, and that work is rich with stories about the time he spent in Hawaii. Those stories are being brought to life in a one-man show at Manoa Valley Theater by Jerry Tracy, and Jerry's on the line from the Big Island. Good morning, Jerry.
Good morning, Chris.
Pretty irresistible subject, isn't it?
Yes, Mark Twain has a special place in my heart, and I really love the old guy. He's from Missouri, like I am, so we're good people of the earth.
Well, like him, like you, he's ranged far and wide, and he found himself in Hawaii as a reporter, and got during the time he spent here, he covered some amazing stories, didn't he?
Yes, he did, and one of the most amazing is about the survivors of the clipper ship Hornet that he ended up interviewing some of those survivors. And in this show that I'm doing at Manoa Valley Theater, I mentioned that at the end of my show, and then sort of leave a hook saying, but that's another story. So I don't really delve into that story because, you know, it's exciting and dramatic. There's not a lot of humor in it, though, and that's what I go for, is the humor, because Mark Twain's humor is undeniable, and I love it.
When you read the writers, the great American writers who preceded Twain, and I'm thinking of Melville and Hawthorne and Fenimore Cooper, their style seems kind of European as compared to Mark Twain.
Yes, indeed. And many people say that Mark Twain gave America a voice, and I think there's much truth to that. He decided not to go with the Eurocentric way of telling stories, and wrote in vernacular much of the time. And of course, he was condemned for it, widely and broadly at first. But then, of course, now over the years, we've come to realize that. For instance, The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn is probably one of the finest American books ever written.
No doubt. Hemingway said that American literature began with Huckleberry Finn.
Yeah, began with Mark Twain, yeah.
Well, you know, just referring briefly to the story of the Hornet, because it was an amazing story of survival at sea and the I think the didn't the survivors turn up in Hilo?
Yeah, Lapa-Hoi-Hoi.
They
washed ashore in a longboat in Lapa-Hoi-Hoi, and then I think they were then taken to Hilo and then eventually to Honolulu, where Anson Burlingame arranged for Twain to be taken there on a cot because he was suffering from saddle boils from riding around the Big Island on a mule. And so he took Twain to the hospital where they were in a cot, and Twain did the interviews lying down.
Which gave him an amazing national, I mean, that was quite a journalistic coup.
Yes, it was. It was, and it was his probably the pinnacle of that part of his job, being the roving reporter for the Honolulu correspondent for the Sacramento Union.
Well, it had a lot to do with making his national reputation, don't you think? The work that he did.
Yes, right. Because shortly after that, he came back to the mainland and started his speaking tour, where he related his experiences in the Sandwich Islands, and so Ron Powers calls him the first American rock star. he at first was petrified to do it, to speak in front of people, and then he really cottoned on to it and became quite the raconteur, as it were.
Which totally fuels your performance, doesn't it, Jerry? Because
yes, indeed, yes.
He was
because
one of the.
I play Twain as the old man in with white hair in the white linen suit, reminiscing and looking back on his time when he came to Hawaii.
And by that time, his persona was very well honed. Yeah.
By that time, he's well comfortable in his position in America and society. And when he came to Hawaii, and not so much. He was 31 years old and full of spunk, but still looking for himself.
Yeah, kind of making his bones as a reporter. And even you can even see the writing style kind of coming into being. Yeah.
Right. Yes. Yes.
Well, you've had to study his work pretty closely. Have you sort of gone through the range of the early journalistic stuff and then,
I can't say that I have gotten through everything he wrote because he was so prolific.
Yeah.
But I certainly, for my show, I draw on many different, and not only his letters from Hawaii, which is the backbone of the show,
mm-hmm.
but then I also... I have a section from Letters from the Earth, which is part of his late dark writing, which unbelievably was not even published until I was in high school, for crying out loud. I can't believe it.
It scared people, Letters from the Earth.
Yeah, it did. It is. Well, it is pretty scary, some of it, and pretty hard to swallow for some people. And then I also, when his autobiography, Part One, came out in 2010, also supplied me with some more information for the show and quotes from hither and yon. It's sort of a pastiche I put together of a Valentine to Mark Twain, as it were.
Well, Jerry, I hope you get in the one about Wagner's music being a lot better than it sounds.
Oh, yes. He had many.
He's good at that stuff.
To say about the Germans and German people and the German opera. Yeah, he was.
Well, Jerry, good to talk to you, and good luck with your show, yeah?
Yeah, nice to talk to you again, Chris, and thank you for your support.
Always. Jerry Tracy is the artistic director of Kona's Aloha Performing Arts Company. He's coming to Oahu to perform Mark Twain Rides Again, his one-man show adapted from the 1866 newspaper columns that Samuel Langhorne Clemens wrote for the Sacramento Union. That's Monday and Tuesday, May 26th and 27th at Manoa Valley Theater, and details are at hpr2.org.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper. This week we're celebrating food from around the globe. From the Basque Country in Spain, where a young sheep herder is making a standout cheese, to the food of the Philippines, to one of the most enviable spice cabinets in the world in Midtown Manhattan. That's The Splendid Table from 8 p.m.
Saturday morning at 9, following Weekend Edition.
Chris, we started the hour talking about what's happening with OHA and the idea of whether or not the Hawaiian Kingdom is in fact still existing. And careful listeners to this program may remember that back in April we had intimations of what has since happened when Bill Sage talked with Professor Williamson Chang, and that was right before that April 17th panel when a lot of this began to come out and the genesis of that letter took root.
This is a discussion that's going to be, you know, it's not going to go away now. It's not going to subside. The letter having been released, whether it's rescinded or not, whatever, however it ends up, that discussion is not going to go away.
Well, as Kamana Beamer says, you know, this is sort of moving the agenda forward and questions that needed to be asked and whether they should have been asked before the Hawaiian roll call or whether they are just being asked now. However they're being asked, they need to be looked at. That seems to be the point that many people are making, and certainly we'll have much more to talk about it as this moves forward.
Yeah, well, certainly the effect is of a question whose time had come.
Yeah, lots of questions and a lot more time we'll spending talking about them. That's going to do it for us this week, though. Now, has the real battle for net freedom just begun? On Monday, we're going to look at the FCC rules now up for debate. We'll talk with Todd O'Boyle of Common Cause in Washington, D.C.
And the always exuberant Dana Land will bring us a preview of her new show, Tropicabana, a musical romp through the tropics.
In the meantime, you can let us in on your radio talkback. Find us on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation. Tweet us at HI Conversation or me at BKOZHPR, where you can also sound off.
If you want to hear today's show again, get another past show or links to more information, check the archive on the HPR website, hpr2.org. Our executive producer is Beth Ann Kozlovich.
Lillian Song produces the program. Taylor Rice is our production assistant.
And the Backyard Quiz theme was written for us by John DeMello. I'm Chris Vanderkirk.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you on Monday and pick up the conversation. Have a good weekend.